So animal rights kind of related to this multi-decade organic growth of interest in these products. There's also been animal rights activists and leaders and groups have played such an important role in awareness about the animal cruelty and even environmental violations of traditional industrial agriculture. And now it seems like everybody knows that factory farms exist, that our meat is coming from these confined animal feeding operations and the animals live a horrific existence. But that wasn't always the case. And it took these decades of animal rights activism to bring that awareness into the mainstream. So now that that is kind of a mainstream awareness, you see that now with these new products like Beyond Meat, the Impossible Burger, they're very deliberately not making an explicit animal rights appeal, even if that was maybe what motivated them to start making the product in the first place. The animal rights component has definitely taken a backseat on the production end because they no longer need to make such a kind of polarizing yet necessary appeal.
Well, that was right where we signed off in the first of a two-part series on meat alternatives. So here, as promised, is the second episode. Hello and a warm welcome. And if this is the first time that you're tuning in, a big warm welcome to the Mission Chunia podcast. I'm your host, Girish Shivakumar. I had a few engagements over the last couple of weeks. I attended a few events and hosted one. As always, met a whole new range of people and a few people outside of India as well. Of course, I do mention about the Mission Chunia podcast, and non-native Indian speakers and guests typically ask me the question of what is the meaning of Shunya? Shunya means zero in the native Indian language of Sanskrit. Shunya for me signifies a transition to a zero carbon economy. No emissions from power plants, no emissions from vehicles, and also zero waste, and of course the circular economy. This is episode 15, and by now I have covered most of these topics on the podcast. I highly encourage you to check the podcast archives. Now on to this week's show. This is the second part of the two episodes on meat alternatives. If you haven't listened to the previous one, please check episode 14 on your podcast feeds. The two special guests for this special mini-series on meat alternatives, Laura from Chatham House in the UK and Mira from New Harvest in the US. They discussed about the need for considering meat alternatives and the evolving policy landscape in the EU and US in the first part. On the second part, we will discuss about the consumer side of things and what are the options for the consumer and more. So I understand that meat is just one of the many products of cellular agriculture. What are the other products that we in general wouldn't know probably, but are already in the market?
So I would say that the first cellular agriculture product is artificial insulin. And so that's been happening for a while. And Perfect Day and Clara Foods, which kind of reprogram microorganisms to make these animal proteins, that's really just building upon the same technology and the same idea of artificial insulin. The heme molecule in the Impossible Burger, which has blown up in the last 6 months. The Impossible Burger is a plant-based burger, but its claim to fame is that it's the burger that bleeds, which is what makes it especially more meaty than the generations of veggie burgers that came before. And the reason that it bleeds is because they culture this heme molecule to produce it from microorganisms instead of from an animal. And so that is a now very widely available CellAg product.
That is Mira from New Harvest. As she mentions about the Impossible Burger and their claim to fame, she also gives an opinion of how companies are evolving in the US in this space.
We're at an inflection point, and in the last few years, there's definitely been a huge jump in the amount of number of people making these plant-based or cell-based meat animal product alternatives. But the inflection point and their growth and rate of growth is entirely dependent upon and building upon a multi-decade series of organic kind of growth in interest in plant-based meat alternatives. And they just happen to come in at this time where they're able to build upon this already established consumer interest and comprehension and understanding and apply this recent technology to escalate and have this rapid growth. So the last few years have been really critical and have been this juncture and a marked, you know, new era from the past, but their growth would not have been possible without these many years of a more kind of crunchy granola vegetarian alternative scene.
How do you see the perception or the general public perception towards these companies and their products change in the last few years? I hope it has seen a positive impact, but what's the reality in the market in the US?
Yeah, it's seen a positive impact. They've had a very revolutionary marketing campaign in that there's been this realization that just because something isn't an animal product doesn't mean that it necessarily has to be healthy. Before, people were combining the whole cruelty-free, animal-free element with a health appeal. Whereas now that that's been separated, they've unrolled a lot of these alternatives like the Beyond Burger, like the Impossible Burger in a fast food setting. So they're marketing and trying to appeal to people that eat meat already and, you know, are interested in a plant-based alternative if it tastes exactly the same, but they don't necessarily care about it being healthy. They care about what it tastes like. And so this fast food partnership model is pretty revolutionary, I think, and has really affected the way it's been received by consumers in a positive way.
In recent months, the lawmakers in the US have been tough on the meat industry, especially in the way the products are labeled and marketed. Considering what is happening in the US, I asked the Chatham House policy expert, Laura, on how important it is for policymakers to lay out recommendations for labeling, especially as the US is preparing for an influx of meat alternatives in the market pretty soon.
I mean, I think very important. Policy and regulatory decisions taken now could really make or break the future of the meat and log industry. One of the most immediate ways in which that might play out is around this question of labelling. There's been a number of studies in recent years looking at how important product names are to consumer perceptions of those products. So what you call something really matters to whether that product is seen as appealing and enticing. And much of the debate around labelling is around whether consumers are misled or not. But once you've kind of established some ground rules on that and say you're starting from a point of labelling that is clear and that isn't misleading, the extent to which meat alternative producers can use familiar terms that consumers will already be well used to will really affect, I think, their ability to take a share of the conventional meat market and to do so in any near short time frame. But it's not just about the regulation of these products and technologies, it's also about the broader policy environment. So, for example, a move by governments to introduce ambitious action to cut emissions in the food system could spur greater investment in meat alternatives, as well as more sustainable practices in conventional meat production. Equally, new initiatives in support of the circular economy could benefit producers in the meat alternative space if they can show that they're reducing their resource inputs and that they're moving towards a more sustainable resource management approach. So I think it's important to not think solely of regulation, but also of the policy environment, what kind of incentives and support mechanisms or disincentives and rules and regulations are in place that could encourage or discourage further innovation and investment in this space.
So how important is it for the US market at this point in time?
It's so important. And what's interesting is, so there's been this, like I said earlier about the whole naming situation for plant-based substitutes to animal products. But with these cell-based, not even just imitations, but, you know, cell-based, still molecularly, like chemically identical animal products that just didn't come from an animal, then you have the issue of you need to label it as such as regular animal products are labeled because people have allergies. And the plant-based alternatives don't have the same allergens as the substances they're trying to imitate, whereas these cell-based foods do. And so that makes the naming challenges different, very distinctly, for the plant-based versus cell-based foods.
In terms of the price differential of the actual products, do you see any price variation between the traditional meat and the meat alternative in the market?
Yeah, the alt meats, be it plant-based or cell-based, are definitely more expensive. But that's because it's a newer technology that doesn't have the economy of scale. Also, traditional agriculture products are so dramatically subsidized by the government that they have artificially deflated prices. And so the question is there a world in which some of those subsidies can be redistributed towards these meat alternatives or animal product alternatives? And that shifts the price differential significantly. Right now, there are so many confounding variables contributing to the dramatic price difference.
It's good to know that you mentioned about the subsidy part of the food industry. That is a global phenomenon. The essential part of the food industry is definitely subsidized by most governments. But as an organization that incubates startups in this space, what are the other kind of incentives that you are looking from governments? Suppose a new harvest had to come to a new region and start incubating startups in the region. What are the general kind of support that you would require from governments, say in US and around the world?
The biggest support that we need from the government is support for academic research. There is infinite interest in incubating startups because there are infinite investors that want to make money from what has been demonstrated to be a very promising technology. But you can't conduct or create an entirely new industry or new technology that's so scientifically based through startups. You need to have an academic foundation in order to have research and breakthroughs that happen that everybody can iterate upon that are openly accessible and not hidden behind IP. You need an academic world in which new talent and expertise can be incubated. And what we need most is for governments to fund academic research and make it a priority in their funding pipelines and apparatuses.
So we know what the industry expects in terms of support from the governments, but there is also a need to balance the consumer side of things in terms of labeling. And also there is this acceptance from the conventional meat industry. How is the European Union planning to address that?
Well, I mean, it's an issue that isn't really for us to kind of make a statement on in terms of how these products should be named. There are lots of different considerations for policymakers to take into account. But what I think is kind of clear coming from discussions in the US and in the EU is that there's a real sense of fear in the conventional meat industry that these meat alternatives will take a significant share of their market. And one of the ways in which the conventional meat industry is responding to that is to call for protected status of certain terms, things like burger and sausage, but also steak or wing, things that are of course traditionally associated with meat, but many of which have been used for plant-based products for decades. So personally, I would be concerned if policymakers were to push ahead with any regulation that restricted the use of those terms without first really probing the evidence as to whether consumers are in fact being misled. And there are many suggestions from plant-based producers who've been in this space for a long, long time that isn't the case. Equally, it's really crucial that the decision process is transparent. And again, I keep saying it, but it is crucial that it's evidence-based. And that means also recognising that there are strong interests on both sides, not just on the conventional meat side, but on the meat alternative producers side and amongst civil society groups who have an agenda to push. So I think transparency is absolutely key. And what we call for in the report is a well-managed and coordinated approach to considering all the available evidence and doing so in a way that ensures independent decision-making. Because if policymakers are influenced one way or the other without due consideration, then we risk heading down a path that is later found to be unsubstantiated or, you know, the wrong path.
That perfectly leads me to my final question on this, on the terms of recommendation. You mentioned about evidence-based policymaking and being transparent in the process. How do you see this panning out? Do you think the governments are going to take time in terms of policy formulation in the space? Are they going to wait for the meat industry to kind of give them time to change, or will they lay out an alternative path for the say, plant-based meat and meat alternatives?
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy question to answer, I think. I guess policymakers are pushed in terms of time. So cultured meat producers, the main companies producing cultured meat, expect their products to be commercially available within the next 5 to 10 years. In the EU, that means that, you know, at least 2 years really before that, they'll need to be putting in a license to the EU for consideration under the novel food regulation. And so by that point, EU policymakers will need to have the processes in place to deal with those applications. So it certainly is a near-term challenge, I think, for policymakers to get to grips with. In the case of plant-based meat, most of these products are already on the market in the EU. The ones around which there's a question is really, at the moment, impossible foods products that use gene editing in their, you know, genetically modified yeast in their production process. And so at the moment, that couldn't be regulated under the novel food. It would be regulated under the GMO regulation in the EU. But at the moment, there's no application for the Impossible Burger to be put on the EU market. But watching what's happening in the US, I think EU policymakers would be remiss to not start considering how they would regulate that and whether those products would be permitted on the EU market if and when an application is received.
At this point in time, the market for meat alternatives means the US market. So how is it likely to grow in the coming years?
I mean, I see it growing, continuing to have this type of exponential growth, but that will ultimately flatten out. We're at this interesting point where these, like I said, traditional animal agriculture companies are, now that it's been demonstrated to be successful, consumers have demonstrated interest, these big food companies are looking to get involved, and they can take the technology to the next level, obviously. So I anticipate huge growth based on existing giants and conglomerates getting involved and not necessarily co-opting the technology, although they might try and do that too, but fit it into their kind of portfolio of food.
What is currently happening at New Harvest? Anything exciting that we should keep a lookout for?
Sure. Our fellows are always doing very interesting work. One of our fellows is growing meat cells on decellularized vegetables, like growing meat on celery sticks. So they're always doing very interesting research. We're about to admit a new kind of cohort of fellows. We're going to have a conference. We just finished our conference. Our next one will be in July. And it's just a huge period of growth for us as well as it is for the industry.
On a final note, I know that I believe that you haven't had an experience to taste the meat alternatives, but I'm sure you would have interacted with a lot of consumers, meat consumers, as part of the feedback that you seek from the market. What is the feedback in general? How is it positive? Are people more enthusiastic about it, or are they willing to adopt this in the long run?
Yeah, I think that people are enthusiastic. People are very curious about it. I haven't tasted any meat alternatives, but Perfect Day's ice cream, the one where it's a milk protein ice cream made from microorganisms, they call it a flora-based ice cream. New Harvest actually had a tasting of that yesterday, where a lot of our friends, people in New York came, and we tasted their 3 pints of ice cream, the vanilla salted fudge, the vanilla blackberry toffee, and the milky chocolate. And people loved it. People thought that it tasted like regular ice cream because, I mean, it wasn't a coconut milk based. It was still a milk protein based ice cream. And everyone was over the moon excited and loved it.
But yes, as promised in the last episode, I have a very special guest who has tasted the meat alternatives available in the US market. So let's listen in to what she has to say.
Hello, my name is Madison. I live in Colorado in the United States. and I've tried a few different meat alternatives. I've been a vegetarian for a long time and, you know, do kind of eat meat every once in a while. But it's definitely preferable at home to be able to cook all vegetarian. And so one of my favorite new recipes has to do with is the brand Qorn, Q-U-O-R-N. They have really good fake chicken and other alternatives that I think actually has a pretty impressive texture and it just has a good flavor. Like, it doesn't gross me out or anything. I have tried another alternative chicken that I didn't like that was a Beyond Meat one, but I think it's because I didn't cook it well. So I think there is definitely a learning curve in terms of how you cook it and trying to find the right recipes. I did also have, I think it was Beyond Meat, the beef alternative in like mince form inside of someone's chili they made. And I really liked that just because in chili, you know, it's going to blend in with all the flavors and spices anyway. So it's just adding that protein and a little bit of texture to the soup. I haven't tried the actual Impossible Burger or even the Beyond Burger just because I don't normally eat burgers anyway. But I do think there's a really good market for it, both for people that, you know, are vegetarians that want to get protein somehow, or, you know, people that do like to eat meat but just kind of want to cut back on their consumption, maybe save a little bit of money, maybe save, you know, some emissions or be helpful to the environment. So there's definitely a market for it, at least, you know, in the area that I live and with people my age. I think people are starting to become more open to it, which is really great to see. I think there's a lot of exciting and new possibilities out there for it. So definitely recommend trying the Qorn brand if you like that. There's a lot of other, you know, soy and other like grown-based products like tempeh and things too. That are worth trying if you haven't tried them before. I recently discovered that baked tofu with barbecue sauce is really delicious if you like barbecue sauce. So yeah, definitely worth trying. Thanks so much for talking about this on the podcast. It's so great to share and get more information. Thanks so much.
A big shout out goes out to Madison. Thanks for coming on the podcast and sharing your views on meat alternatives available in the US market. I'm sure listeners from around the world will definitely give it a try wherever they can find one. Thanks again. And with that, it's a wrap on this special two-part series. The action item towards Mission Shunya is go get your hands on a meat alternative wherever you can. Just give it a try before making a decision. And yes, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with yet another podcast episode. If you liked what you heard, let me know. Special thanks to all the listeners who have given the show a 5-star rating and wrote a review on Apple Podcasts. So the next time, if you want to give a review, also mention your social media handles so that I can give you a shout out from my social media channels, which happens to be at Mission Shunya on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can also write me an email, missionshunya@gmail.com. The webpage for Mission Shunya, which is missionshunya.com, is undergoing a makeover and it'll be up and running in a few weeks' time. I would be grateful if you can share the episode and the podcast to 3 people, 3 friends or colleagues in the coming week. It'll definitely help spread the word. So I hope you do that. A big thanks in advance. So signing off, this is Mission Shunya, towards a zero carbon economy.